Let's see. I thought today we could open by looking at the end of Matthew. Last time we looked at the beginning of Matthew, and today it might be good to look at the end of Matthew. Part of the reason for this, of course, is to say that the beginning and the end of a story is often very important, especially at signaling what the author wants you to get out of it all. Okay? So what we're going to look at today is, in some ways, what did Matthew want us to get out of the story? Okay? You'll recall that last time we talked about Abraham and David and the exile and how these three themes were relevant to Jesus. So the beginning and end of a story is often very significant for determining what it was that the author wanted you to get out of the whole thing. Abraham, David, exile, opening of the story of Matthew. And we noted especially last time about that, that Jesus then is the Davidic Messiah. He is the one who is coming in the line of David. He is therefore the Christ, the anointed one, the Messiah. And that he's also in the lineage of Abraham, and that Abraham was giving promises that not only would he be blessed, but he would be a blessing to all the world, basically, to all the nations, if you would. And that when you come to the end of the story, at the end of book of Matthew, the Great Commission says, go therefore and make disciples of all the nations. And so you see this fulfillment at the end of the promise at the beginning that this Messiah, David, is in the line of Abraham, who will be a blessing to all the nations. We also saw the very first day of class some themes that tie in, or a major theme that ties into the end of the story. There we saw it in Matthew chapter 2 with the Magi and the way that they came to worship, and that theme of worship is also tied into this end of the story of Matthew. Because what happens when the 11 disciples proceed to Galilee and they see Jesus, they worship him. Okay? So that is, I think, significant, although the worship in the Magi isn't the beginning, strictly speaking, of the story in Matthew. It is the first time you meet Jesus in the story. And the first response to Jesus in the book of Matthew is worship. And the last response to Jesus in the book of Matthew is worship. So we see those two themes. Now, all that to say that, by means of review, that we've touched on some of the themes in the so-called Great Commission, which is at the end of the story of the book of Matthew. And I want to look at that today. I'm going to limit myself, just for sake of time. We need to get back to our discussion of backgrounds. And so I'm going to just, whatever we can do in the next 15 minutes, and I'll just stop. And if there's any more to be done with the Great Commission, we'll go on later. Now, as soon as I do this, I do it with some hesitation, because I know, especially if you've worshipped in evangelical churches for some period of time, you are very aware of the Great Commission. And we become dull of hearing because we hear so often. Okay, we just had a missions conference at our church, and it goes through the end of this week. And we had a wonderful sermon on the Great Commission on Sunday. And that is not the whole reason I'd already planned on talking about this, but it motivated me yet again to talk about the Great Commission. Yet, I mean, I have to say that every time the sermon comes up in the Great Commission, I mean, deep down, just honestly, between you and I, nobody else, okay, turn off the video. No, you don't have to turn off the video, but just between you and I, you know, I'm kind of like, oh, again. Okay? So if you have the oh, again feeling, I understand it. Let me suggest that generally, because the Great Commission only comes up at missions conference time, that we've missed a lot of what's going on in the Great Commission. Okay? I already pointed out the worship theme, which I have yet to hear somebody bring out in any significant way in any sermon on the Great Commission. And yet I think that's one of the most striking themes in the whole of Matthew and here in Matthew 28. So let's look at a few other things here. And along the way, we will have hit the talk about missions. Can't omit that. And in fact, we would be in sin, I would almost say, if we did. But there's other stuff going on here as well. So if you would turn with me to Matthew 28, I'm going to start in verses 16 and following. But the 11 disciples, and it's of course 11 because Judas has just previously killed himself in the book of Matthew. Okay. for his betrayal. But the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had designated. Now, by the way, I often think of the Great Commission as being in and around Jerusalem. I mean, the last part of Jesus' ministry is in and around Jerusalem. But he's up north in Galilee yet again. So he's back in his home territory. This is removed from Jerusalem, removed from where we think of as the center of the beginning of the Christianity with Pentecost, etc. This is much more up in the Galilee, where there's more of a mixing of Gentiles and Jewish people. Also, Jesus' country land. So anyway, that's where we are. Proceeded to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had designated. And when they saw him, they worshipped him. And we've already talked about the importance of that. They worshipped him. But some were doubtful. Now, I don't know about you, but that word bothers me quite a lot. I mean, here they are seeing the risen Jesus, and this isn't the only time. They are seeing the risen Jesus, who is about to deliver to them his last and greatest commandment, and we're dealing with, according to this narrative, his 11 disciples. It doesn't mention anybody else. There could have been other people present. That might have been part of the sum, but the natural way to read this is the 11 disciples. These are the people who've been with Jesus from the beginning. They've seen his crucifixion, they've witnessed his resurrection, they've heard his teaching, etc., etc. And so you would think all of them would be bowing down in full faith and submission to him, and yet the narrative says, but some were doubtful. Now, what do we do with that? Well, I'm not wholly sure, honestly, but I have a few ideas, and let me toss a few of them out at you. One is, do you realize that this goes against what a lot of people say is going on in the Gospels now. If you talk about the secular kind of world that's out there, they will say of Jesus' followers, especially with regard to his miracles, that these people were inclined to believe pretty much anything. You know, they were back there in the dark period, before science, before you had, you know, computers and Palm Pilots, and before people were aware of the nature of you know, this cause and effect in the sequence of events. And so, therefore, they had no problem, blind faith, going in, believing anything that Jesus did is a miracle. Even if, you know, he was actually walking on a sandbar rather than walking in the middle of the lake, which is, by the way, found in a number of commentaries to explain Jesus' walking on water. Now, when I come to this passage, I see instead a realism that is here by Matthew as author. He's not going to just simply say everybody followed him. He's going to acknowledge that some people were doubtful. And actually, if you look just above this, previously in Matthew 28, there's this whole little narrative about the guards who were supposed to guard the tomb, and all of a sudden the tomb is empty, and so what in the world are they going to do about this? Well, in theory, the guards should be put to death. But the high priests and people around him take counsel, and they offer money to the soldiers instead to say that the disciples stole away the body. Now, and then he says that, by the way, this story was widely circulated to this day. This also shows that Matthew not only is aware of alternative possibilities for the resurrection, but he's aware of the stories that are going around in his day, and he just frankly acknowledges them. And thus, we shouldn't be surprised that he frankly acknowledges people's doubt, even when they see the risen Lord. Okay? In my mind, this actually increases the historical reliability of the author in that regard. Okay. Now, aside from that, I do have to wonder if there are some possible theological themes going on in Matthew at this stage. And there are a couple of other places in the book of Matthew where doubt is explicitly mentioned, especially with regard to Jesus' disciples. So one is found in Matthew chapter 14, and the word itself shows up in Matthew 14:31, but the context, and I think if I just read this, you'll get enough of it. And Jesus said, "Come," and Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said to him, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? And when they got into the boat, the wind stopped, and those who were in the boat worshipped him. Oh, there's our word worship again, saying, you are certainly God's son. A very interesting combination of worship and doubt, simultaneous with one another. Okay? So this seems, certainly in Matthew chapter 14, this is indicting Peter, yes, for his doubt. But implicitly, I mean, did any other disciple hop out of the boat and walk around to Jesus? No. Would you hop out of the boat and walk to Jesus? And I think as we read the narrative, we're supposed to ask that question of ourselves. And to the extent that there's any little part of us that would say no, Jesus would reply, O you of little faith, why did you doubt? Now, I'm not saying we need to hop out of every boat then. Jesus has to be present, and it has to be, you know, clearer circumstances for a miracle. But the point is, just where are the limits of your faith? And where do you doubt? The other place where the word doubt shows up is in Matthew 21. And here it's in Matthew 21, verse 21. But if I start again back in verse 19, I think you'll get enough of a context to feel what this is about. So Matthew 21, 19. And seeing a lone fig tree by the road, Jesus came to it and found nothing on it except leaves only. And he said to it, no longer shall there ever be any fruit from you. And at once the fig tree withered. And seeing this, the disciples marveled, saying, how did the fig tree wither at once? And Jesus answered and said to them, truly I say to you, if you have faith and do not doubt, if you have faith and do not doubt, you shall not only do what was done to the fig tree, but even if you say to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, it shall happen. And all things you ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive. Now that's the end of the narrative. What's striking to me is the next thing that follows in the narrative in Matthew 21 is this. And when Jesus had come to the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? Well, of course, in Matthew 28, right after they're doubtful, Jesus comes up and speaks to them and says, all authority has been given on heaven and earth to me. So there are some interesting connections with the Matthew 21 fig tree passage as there are with the Peter in the water passage. And both of them call the disciples to determine what the limits of their faith are and to ask, why do you have any doubt at all? And so, although I am not certain why in Matthew 28, at the beginning of the Great Commission, Matthew reports that they worshipped him and some were doubtful, I suspect, and this is just a suspicion, that it is calling all of us to ask ourselves at that point, at the end of this wonderful narrative about Jesus, at the end of the whole story of Jesus, from his birth, through his miracles and his teachings, through his crucifixion, through his resurrection, to ask us at the end of the narrative, are we among those who are doubtful? And I suspect that that's what we're supposed to do at this stage there. By the way, just to be overt in my methodology, notice what I did here. I didn't go outside to compare doubt in John or doubt in the book of Acts or doubt anyplace else, although there is some validity to that. I principally am interested how this word and the associations with it work in the book of Matthew. And therefore, at the end of the book of Matthew, when he uses that same term, because Jesus used it, and he's using it thematically to bring up against the motifs that were earlier in the book, what is going on in the book of Matthew? That's what I'm asking there. And I suspect he's asking us to ask our own faith stance there. Okay. So verse 17, and when they saw him, they worshipped, but some were doubtful. So where are you at in respect to Jesus? Are you doubtful? Where is your faith? And then secondly, what is your response? Are you really worshiping God in all of your life. But verse 18 goes on, and Jesus came up and spoke to them, saying, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." Now again, these are words that we read over. Usually the preacher uses them as a opportunity to talk about how great Jesus is on the way to getting you convinced that you need to be doing missions. But we need to ask if there's more to this word authority in the book of Matthew, whether this too is a theological motif throughout the book of Matthew. Here's some examples in terms of authority in Matthew. Okay, I'm going to go through these quickly. I just have a list in front of me, so I'm going to go through them quickly. Although it'd be best to look at these entirely in context for sake of time, I think just giving you the clip that I give you may be sufficient. Matthew 7:29, people are amazed, for he was teaching them as one having authority. Jesus teaches them as one having authority and not as their scribes. So at the beginning, towards the beginning of Matthew, after he finishes teaching, this is the end of the Sermon on the Mount, the first great long passage of Jesus' teaching in the book of Matthew. At the end of it, the response is, they are amazed. Why? Because he's teaching as one having authority. So there Jesus is claiming authority vis-a-vis his teaching, right? In Matthew 9:6, you will know that this is at the end of the healing of the man who is a paralytic. Right after Jesus has forgiven him his sins, and Matthew 9:6 says, "But in order that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," then he said to the paralytic, "Rise, take up your bed, and go home." Now there's two interesting things with authority in that context. One is the display of Jesus' authority comes via the miracle, but the authority he's actually claiming is the authority to forgive sins, which is something, of course, that belongs only to the prerogative of God. So in some sense, he's already claiming the authority of God Almighty. From the perspective of the scribes and Pharisees, he is usurping the authority of God Almighty. So he's claiming the authority to forgive sins. And the response uses the word as well, but when the multitude saw this is in verse 8 of chapter 9, they were filled with awe and glorified God who had given such authority to men. Okay? It is interesting that right after that, or shortly after it, in chapter 10, Jesus chooses to send out his disciples, which after all is exactly what he's doing in Matthew chapter 28, back in the Great Commission. And he says, "And having summoned his 12 disciples, he gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to heal every kind of disease and every kind of sickness." There, Jesus not only possesses authority, he possesses the authority to give away authority. And then his disciples have the authority to perform some of the same miracles that he himself has. And ultimately, this leads us to the question, which we saw earlier in Matthew 21, when we were talking about doubting, that when Jesus comes to the temple after performing again a number of amazing miracles, the chief priests and the elders of the people came to him as he was teaching and said, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority?" So there his authority is being challenged yet again. And Jesus answered and said to them, "I will ask you one thing too, which if you tell me, I will also tell you by what authority I do these things." And in that respect, he challenges them with another narrative. I don't want to go into all of that. So Jesus is claiming authority. They recognize his claim to authority, but they question his claim to authority. All right? There is another place, that's, by the way, those are the main places where the same Greek word for authority is used throughout the book of Matthew. So that's how I found those locations. Okay, quick word search. But those are not the only places where authority is claimed. In other words, you can do something without using the actual word. You can claim authority without using the actual word. And probably one of the most interesting ones, and one that we'll return to later, is in Matthew 26. And this is where Jesus is on trial I would prefer to think of it as a kind of preliminary hearing before the Sanhedrin. And we'll talk more about why I argue that in a few days. So he's on a preliminary hearing before the Sanhedrin in Matthew 26, starting in verse 57 and following. And there are a number of false charges that are being brought against him, and they are looking for some excuse to put him to death. You guys know the context. And the high priest stands up and says to Jesus, I'm in verse 62 of chapter 26, for those of you who are following along. Do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? But Jesus kept silent, because they're giving false witness against him, and he just keeps silent. And the high priest says to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself, which is a backdoor way of saying, yes, I am. Okay. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his robe, saying, he has blasphemed. Now, we will talk in a few days about the implications for the trial of Jesus as to what's going on here, but there is the question as to what constituted the blasphemy here. It is typically among evangelicals thought, just because we read this narrative maybe a little too quickly, that the claim to authority, that the claim to being the Messiah is what led to Jesus' downfall into the claim of blasphemy. But you know, if you read ancient Jewish sources, it is not blasphemy to claim to be the Messiah. Also, if you read Jewish sources, you'll find that Jesus was not the only person to claim to be the Messiah. And they weren't typically put to death for blasphemy. So it can't simply be his claim to be the Messiah. I would suggest to you that what led to the charge of blasphemy against Jesus is when he says, the Son of Man sitting, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Why was that blasphemy? Because he is claiming to have the very authority of God Almighty. He is claiming that he is going to be the one sitting on the right hand of the Son of God, the right hand of God. Notice he says the Son of Man. Everybody knew that that was Jesus' own self-designation for who he was. So when he says, you'll see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, you mean you yourself are going to be sitting at the right hand of God the Father Almighty in heaven, dispensing his authority to the rest of the nations? That's the very authority that Jesus is claiming there. Now, he is put to death for claiming that authority. Because, frankly, honestly, if he was not the Son of God, then it was blasphemy. Because he is claiming to be God Almighty. So, frankly, is that going off? You might want to take it out, Adam, if you can, just so it doesn't annoy other people. Thank you. So, in short, if he is not who he claims to be, they were right to put him to death, according to the Old Testament law. Okay? But the whole deal with Matthew is the resurrection proves that he was who he claimed to be. And therefore, he has the authority he claims. And so that at the end of the book of Matthew, when he says all authority in heaven and on earth is vested in him, we are called to say yes, indeed. That's exactly right. And so what you have through the book of Matthew is this escalation of realization as to who this person is. Okay? At the beginning, people come to worship him. Why? Because he is born a king of the Jews. So there's some inherent authority implicit there. We start to see that working out when he starts teaching with authority. He heals with authority. He forgives sins with authority, thus claiming the prerogative of God himself. He dispenses his authority to his disciples. You see the escalation? It keeps going on. He dispenses his authority to his disciples. And then finally, at the end, right on the moments before he's going to be put to death, he claims to have the very authority of God himself. and then he's crucified. But then the resurrection proves that all of those claims to authority are in fact the case. And so when at the end, instead of saying he's claiming the authority to heal, or authority to forgive sins, he says all authority has been given to me in heaven and in earth. And when we see that, I mean, we should be blown over. But I think we are so dull of hearing because we think of him as God incarnate that we don't realize just how amazing a claim that was and how amazing a truth it is as well. Okay? Now, we didn't actually even get into the so-called Great Commission, did we? We'll have to leave that for next time because I guarantee that there's stuff going on there, especially in the Greek, that you guys need to be aware of that you're not because your English translation smoothed it over. So we'll talk about that a little bit more later. But this is who our Jesus is. He is worthy of our faith, and therefore we have to encounter the degree to which we are doubtful. He is worthy of our worship, and he's worthy of all of this because he possesses all authority in heaven and on earth. Okay. Let's pray, and then we'll move on to our next topic for discussion. Jesus, as we look at a passage such as this, we have to, I think, rightly, first of all, ask your forgiveness. For we recognize that there is a part of us that is indeed doubtful. That there is a part of us that is really does have little faith. That we may believe the right things, we may be able to utter the right things and even deliver a good and earnest theology. But in our day-to-day life, there are times when doubt is manifested because we refuse to step out in faith, even to the extent that Peter himself refused to look confidently on you and simply walk across that water. And yet, Lord, we recognize in the midst of this that you do forgive us, and we thank you for that. We would desire that our whole lives be an acknowledgement of the authority which you yourself possess. Give us the faith to believe that all authority is indeed vested in you, and to worship you in all aspects of our lives, using even these next few minutes in this class to that end. In your wonderful name we pray. Amen. Last time we were discussing the... A bit of the history and the backgrounds of early Judaism, right in the time of Jesus. We had done a few things. Let me just remind you of some of those. We had talked about the geographic context in which Jewish people in the time of Jesus found themselves. We had noted that it was a very pleasant land in many ways because it had agricultural property, especially to the west of the Judean hills and the coastal plain, and also down near the Jordan River, that it was therefore not just good agricultural land, but also made for significant economic trade. Because the Fertile Crescent from Mesopotamia into Egypt went right through Israel. And this explains much of Old Testament history because Israel found itself constantly between the warring nations of Egypt and the various rulers of the Mesopotamian areas and lands. That this was also true even at the time of the New Testament, or at least right before it, when Alexander the Great had marched through as the great Hellenistic conqueror, and he was brought with him the Hellenism with its language, Greek, with its literary culture, with its culture of plays, with its worship of multiple deities, many of which were added to then the kind of recognized deities in the local lands throughout the Mediterranean world. Also with its sense of commerce and the desire to link many territories in trade. That's what Alexander brought with him. But after Alexander, you'll recall that he died at a very early age, in his 30s, and that he didn't leave a designated heir. And in fact, his generals both basically broke up the territory. And the two territories that we were most concerned about were the Seleucid territory and the Ptolemaic territory. The Ptolemies ruled what? Egypt. And the Seleucids ruled what? Persia, yes, Mesopotamia, Persia, ancient Persia. And that right in between, again, was Palestine. That up until 198, Palestine was in the control of the Ptolemies, but after that it went into Seleucid control. And the Seleucids had a much more aggressive Hellenization process that they wanted to inflict on Palestine, especially when Palestine didn't provide sufficient assistance to Antiochus Epiphanes in the midst of his war against the Ptolemies. He insisted on setting up a worship to Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem. And for that reason, that time, and he is known as the Abomination of Desolation, a term which comes up again in the New Testament, and a term which came from the book of Daniel. After Alexander the Great, you had the rise of the Romans in the west. And as the Romans conquered Carthage and Greece and Macedonia and then ultimately Asia Minor, they were heading further and further east until they became a power that the different rulers in Judea eventually had to reckon with. And it is notable that when we get to the time of Herod the Great, Herod's power was ultimately established by the Romans. You'll recall that Herod, his only potential claim to the Hasmonean throne was that he was married to one of the daughters, or the great-granddaughters, of the Hasmoneans. So he had no direct lineage himself. In fact, there were other proper claimants to the throne. But because he had Rome on his side, he was able to take Judea. By the way, he had to divorce his first wife in order to marry the Hasmonean second wife, in order to even have that claim to the throne. And of course, eventually he divorced her and married three others. So Herod's claim to the throne was extremely tenuous. Also, he was Idumean of descent, and so at least he was at best a half-blood, if you would. And so he didn't have the right Jewish claim to the throne either. Herod the Great, you'll recall from your reading in F.F. Bruce, is especially known for his building programs. He is known for having built the temple again. Now, the temple had been built under the time of Ezra, but it was a paltry example of a temple. It didn't look, its glory was not the same as the glory of the first temple, despite the prophetic promises. And ultimately, Herod took upon himself to build this temple into a great and glorious temple. Now, this did two things for him. One is, it made his Jewish subjects pleased. Actually, there's probably three things it did. One is it made its Jewish subjects pleased, because here he was building the great temple. And even the rabbis, who really despised Herod, even 200 years after Herod, write about the glories of that temple and express some appreciation to Herod for that, even though they had a lot of other reasons to dislike him. The second of the three things that occurred to me as I was talking was it provided for quite an economy in Jerusalem itself. Probably a large part of Jerusalem's economy at the end of the first century BC and well into the first century AD focused entirely on the temple. A majority of their economy did, not all of it, but a majority of it did. Both in the normal temple worship practices and the need to buy animals and to sell animals, which of course Jesus overturned the money changers and all of that in the temple precincts, also in the funds that came from the temple tax that all good Jewish people were expected to pay to the temple, but also in the construction project that Herod engaged in. You can think of contemporary events that people love to build buildings around in cities, and city councils will go after major building projects because they know it will bring a lot of work to the city. And especially when you recognize that the construction of the temple, which ultimately, in all of its things, it wasn't actually done until just shortly before the temple was destroyed. The bulk of it was done by Jesus' day, enough that the temple was very much engaging in temple worship practices, etc. But it wasn't even completely done until just before it was destroyed. So this project went on for decades, which brought a lot of economic means to Jerusalem. But the third thing that this did for Herod, apart from his own Jewish people, is it showed how great a Romanized king he was. Okay? Step back for a second. The Romans, when they overtook territory, were often pleased to leave the indigenous leadership intact, as long as the indigenous leadership realized that they were under the thumb of the real power, the Romans. So if you go to a city such as Corinth, I was just talking about Corinth with another class, they have a place known as the Julian Basilica where the Roman governor sat, and then just shortly around the block, if you would, just down the Agora from the Julian Basilica, was the Bouleterion, where the boule, or the city council, basically met in Corinth. And so there was the indigenous leadership of the city council, and also duoviers and aegiles and such were in place in Corinth, but the real power was just around the corner in the Julian Basilica, namely the Romans. So you left powers intact. Well, in kingdoms such as Judea, they left the king intact and made them into a client king. Okay? The term client is a technical term meaning that they were indebted to their patron, who was the emperor himself. Okay? So they were client kings. Now, client kings throughout the Roman Empire had two main characteristics that showed off their glory, aside from just the opulence of their wealth. They had a palace, and they had a temple. And the more glorious your palace and your temple were, the more glorious you were as a king, as seen in the eyes of the rest of your Roman colleagues. So the fascinating thing about this temple is that it worked in two different ways. It worked well with the Jewish people because they saw it as a glorious place for God to be and for Him to be worshipped. And it worked outside of the Jewish context and a Gentile context because it showed just how wonderful a king Herod was. Okay, so we can see a multiple of motives there. And Herod's building programs were not limited to Judea. Like a good client king, like a good benefactor in the ancient world, he gave money to multiple cities to build temples to deities outside of the one God. So he gave money to that. He gave money to games, which were all held in honor of certain deities, etc. So when we look at Herod, we can't say, oh, he was a Jewish king, because in the eyes of at least some of the people, they would have looked at all of that and they would have said, A, he's Idumean, so he doesn't have the right lineage. B, he was never of the Hasmonean line. C, yes, he builds us a temple, but look at all the pagan temples he's building elsewhere. And so you can imagine some of the concerns about him. So anyway, there's some things to say about Herod. Now you will know from your readings that Herod managed to kill off much of his children. He had five wives, so he had several children to choose from. And he knocked off basically his oldest children when he went through, and ultimately had to, at the last minute, draw up a will near the time of his death that left his kingdom divided into three different parts. And two of the leaders were good, and as I said last time, one of the leaders was not worth much, and that was the leader, unfortunately, he put over Judea. And therefore, after his death in 4 BC, the person that he had declared to be his successor ruled for about 10 years until the Romans just got fed up and said, we're going to depose this guy and we're going to put in our own leaders and make it into a Roman province under Roman prefects. Okay? So that's what happened by AD 6. Now, let me go back a couple of things. I had a question after class. When was Jesus born then? Odds are that Jesus, notice that Jesus was born, you know, Matthew 2, while Herod was still around, right? 6 BC, probably. We tend to think of zero. There's actually no year zero, but we tend to think of AD, meaning the year of our Lord, BC, before Christ. Therefore, zero was when Jesus was born. Well, probably it was closer to 6 BC, and when the Gregorian calendar was established, they missed the date, okay? And that's probably the case. By the way, if Herod's willing to put to death his own children, I don't see any problem with him putting to death a few youth in Bethlehem in hopes of quenching any claim to the king of Judah. There. Judea is a Roman province from AD 6 to 41, and there's a number of Roman prefects that come through, the most important of which is Pontius Pilate, who was governor of Judea for 10 years, 26 to 36. A very long reign, long in part because the emperor that he was under, Tiberius, liked to give long reigns to his governors, but also still strikingly a very long reign. Now, the stories of Pontius Pilate are recalled in some ways, respects, in your F.F. Bruce book, and remember that he did a lot of things that really hacked off the Jewish people. I mean, he almost had a revolt two or three times during his reign. And among these is that he brought in symbols to Jerusalem, probably on two different occasions, that would signal to the Jewish people that he was bringing pagan deities into Jerusalem itself. And this caused huge uproar. Between Josephus and Philo, both of whom are Jewish authors in the first century, there is hardly a kind word to be said about Pilate. Okay? Now, as a brief aside, when we end up talking about the trial of Jesus, one of the things that is asserted against the Gospels with regard to the trial of Jesus is that Pilate is too rosy a picture. The picture of Pilate is too rosy in the Gospels. Because remember, Pilate, he doesn't really want to put Jesus to death. I mean, it's almost like he wants to have mercy on this poor guy. And that's not consistent, people will say, with his Jewish context. Well, now, in point of fact, Pilate probably was acting in very strong self-interest there. For one, if he was a governor, a Roman governor, and he put to death somebody who was innocent, he could be held an account of that to the people above him and ultimately to the emperor himself. So there was good reason for him not to want to put to death an innocent person. Secondly, if you read the Gospels carefully, Pilate is afraid, basically, of a revolt. And remember, he's already had a few of these instances. And ultimately, it is an instance of a revolt-ish kind of thing that happens at the end in AD 36. Sorry, I need to put that thing to sleep. He loses his position in the Roman Empire. And as a governor of Judea. So, he probably had a whole mixture of motives going on there that were in some ways conflicting. Doesn't want to put to death an innocent person, but he also doesn't want to have a little rebellion on his hands. Right? So, some things there. Now, after Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, there were a sequence of other prefects. But then eventually we end up with Agrippa the First, king of Judea. Agrippa the First was actually a king in one of the other territories that were initially established when Herod divided his kingdom into three different parts. But Agrippa showed himself to be enough of a leader that the Romans eventually gave him his desire to be king over Judea. This would have been very exciting to the Herodian party, to the people who looked back to the grand old days of Herod, because there were people who liked and benefited from the reign of Herod the Great. He was a king, at least. At least it was better than having these Romans directly in charge. And he also exhibited a kind of power, and undoubtedly there was a wealthy elite that benefited very much from having him in charge. And so there is a group known as the Herodians, who were very excited to have another of the Herodian dynasty or lineage on the king. But unfortunately, Agrippa I died at a very early age in 44. Now, of these dates, notice that there are four that are in bold and italics, and this is true also in your handout. You should know these four dates. 63, Pompey takes Jerusalem. 37 to 4, when Herod the Great ruled Judea. That's B.C. A.D., 6 to 41, Judea, Roman province, and especially 26 to 36, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea. I'm going to stop there. I've recalled a lot. I've given you some more material on the Roman period. Do you guys have any questions at this stage? What is the date for Jesus' crucifixion? Well, this is debated in terms of what exact year we're in, and it has to do with relationships between Passover and what day that was on and things like that, as well as issues of dating as to when the apostolic church arose and things like that and dates there. Our sources don't give us exact dates, so we have to acknowledge that. The Gospels don't give us an exact date, okay? So probably between 30 and 33 here during the reign of Pontius Pilate, so right in the middle of his reign, sometime in there, okay? Dating things in the New Testament is quite tricky. What you usually have to do is rely on some sort of relative chronology. So you know from other sources when Herod the Great ruled Judea, so you figure out from that when Jesus was alive. You know when some of the other figures in the book of Acts, some of the rulers there in and around Judea are in place, so you can do some calculations based on that. One of the most significant dates for dating the whole of the New Testament, aside from the fall of the temple in 70, but around the time of all of this, is that we know the exact year in our system years, but the exact year that Gallio was in charge in Corinth. And we know that Paul, in the book of Acts, went before Gallio in Corinth. And so that provides one of our very few firm dates in the whole of the New Testament, because usually we're dealing with, 10 years when Pontius Pilate was governor, so when in that period was Jesus crucified? And anyway, some discussion on date there. Else? The normal way that you told dates in the ancient world is you said in the 10th year of Tiberius, or in the 12th year in the second year that Varro was governor of Syria or something like that. Varus was governor of Syria. So that's, you would do a relative chronology such as that. But even the Gospels don't tend to do that for us. So that's where we're at. Nathan? 6 B.C. Yeah, probably 6 B.C. Somewhere in that range. Yeah. Yes? It doesn't add up. You said you've always been told your whole life that Jesus was 33. I've heard that a lot, too. Sorry. We don't know. The narrative doesn't describe sufficiently what Pompey saw in there to know whether the Ark and of the Covenant and other things were in the Holy of Holies. We know that he was shocked that he didn't see an idol, because that's what you'd have in any temple. You would have the main cult idol in there. I'll show you a picture of a cult idol. I think I have a picture here later. Okay, excellent questions. All right, continuing through the Roman period. After Agrippa I dies, now we have Roman procurators ruling Judea, so further Roman leadership ruling all of Judea. And the way that Josephus describes this is that the sequence of procurators gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And so he blames a lot of the Jewish revolt on the poor leadership that was chosen for Judea. He's very careful not to blame it on the emperor himself, in part because you'll remember that Josephus, as a writer of Jewish history, is actually being funded by two emperors, Vespasian and Titus later. But he is careful to also indicate that the Jewish people had some reason, even on Roman terms, for revolting. And so he indicates the series of poor leadership. Now, when we get to the revolt against Rome, 66 to 73, with the crucial date being the fall of Jerusalem in 70, we have to understand that there had long been resentment against the Romans at that stage. The party known as the Zealots, which probably was less of a party and more of just kind of a general movement in society, was looking to reestablish true Jewish rule in Judea so that the high priest could be autonomous. Because you'll remember that the vestments of the high priest are actually held for much of this period by the Roman leaders themselves. So when it was time to go into the Day of Atonement, the high priest had to go over, knock on the door. He didn't. He probably sent somebody to do it, but knock on the door and said, "Excuse me, can I have my robes so I can go and do the Day of Atonement?" And they'd have to scrounge around in the basement, pull out the robes, dust them off, give them to him. You know, this is the kind of thing that they had to go through. You can imagine how belittling that was and how dangerous that was from a religious perspective, because it meant that the high priest was no longer autonomous in many ways. So there was a zealot movement to conquer the Romans. When we get to 66, I'm going to just shorten the account and basically say that there were some initial kind of engagements with one another. And the unfortunate thing, frankly, is the Jewish people won, because that gave them hope that they could actually beat the Roman Empire. And that was just silly. The Roman Empire was extended over such a long area and involved so many kingdoms that the only way that they could hope to suppress rebellion is, as soon as one rebellion came up, the danger would be that it would catch like wildfire to other areas. They're like, well, they rebelled in Judea. You know, let's get some autonomy for ourselves too. So as soon as a rebellion came up, they had to absolutely and firmly and categorically squash it and make people pay so dearly that no one would want to do that again. And that's what they did here. Okay? The importance of this rebellion and the way that the Romans saw it can hardly be underestimated. I think on your chart there, do I give you a series of Roman emperors there? Do you notice that there's a year of what's known as the year of four emperors, with Galba and Otho and such? Do you notice who ends up winning? I mean, there's this sequence of, they just keep churning through emperors because people are being poisoned and all these things are kind of going on, and no one can hold on to the imperial mantle. What ultimately has to happen is that the army, as you would expect in kind of any coup, but the army comes and marches towards Rome and says, "This is the person we think should be emperor." And eventually the Senate just kind of says, "Okay, that's fine. You're the army." And they chose a general. And the general they chose was Vespasian. And Vespasian was the general who had conducted the Jewish war. And when Vespasian became emperor, and there was still a little bit of mopping up to do, including taking Jerusalem, Vespasian put in place his son, Titus, who then becomes emperor after him. That's how important the Jewish revolt was. It led to two people becoming emperor. All right? So this was no small matter. When they took Jerusalem, they besieged it. They crucified people outside. They held on to it. People were dying out of lack of nutrition. There's an account in Josephus that a woman ate her own child in Jerusalem. They captured Jerusalem, then came in. The temple itself was fortified. It took a while to capture the temple. By this point, the Jewish revolt is actually revolting against one another. They can't get along with one another. And so they're fighting themselves in the temple precincts while the Romans are waiting outside to capture the temple. Josephus records the narrative of the destruction of the temple like this. The night ahead of time, have I told you this before? I hope not. The night ahead of time, Titus sits outside with his main generals, and they decide, what are they going to do with the temple? Are we going to burn it? Or are we going to keep it? And there's a whole group of people who say, burn it, because the core of the revolt of Jewish people seems to be their religion. Therefore, if we break the back of the religion by burning the temple, that'll be it. But others speak at how glorious the temple is, how it's one of the most amazing buildings ever built, and they give other apologies for the temple. And according to Josephus, Titus decides to let the temple stand. Of course, who sponsored Josephus' writing of the book that recounts all of this? Titus. Okay? So he's certainly making his sponsor look very good. So it's hard to know what the exact truth is there. It's possible, but we don't know. In any case, Josephus records that in the process of taking the temple, it is accidentally, if you would say, set on fire, and the whole temple is burned to the ground. And the result is if you've seen pictures of the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem to this day, you know, people go up to the wall. That is where the Temple Mount used to be. But up on top of the Temple Mount, it was flat. There's actually a mosque up there now. But the Wailing Wall is not the wall of the temple. It's the foundation wall. It's, if you would, it's the wall that's built so they could put the land on top, so they could put the temple on top. In other words, there was no temple left. It was completely gone. And that ended the worship forever in Jerusalem. Masada, some of you may have heard of Masada. This great desert fortress in the south actually falls sometime in 73, possibly 74. And roughly in that time period is when the revolt really ends, because those are the last stalwarts, if you would. But with the fall of Jerusalem, I mean, it was over, basically. Okay. After this, you would think that that would be the end of Judaism as you knew it. However, has Jerusalem and the temple ever fallen before? Yeah, the Babylonian exile, right? How long did that last? Well, roughly 50 years, something like that. 70 years to the reconstruction of the temple. And so there was precedent for hoping that the temple could be reconstructed, right? And evidence of the idea that the temple could be reconstructed and that the Jewish people could regain their autonomy, much as they did after the Babylonian exile, is found in the revolts that followed. One is the revolt under Trajan. These is mostly, our sources at least indicate that this is mostly outside Judea, in the diaspora, especially in Egypt. Okay? That there was a small revolt under Trajan. Trajan was the emperor at the time. The one that we're most interested in is the so-called Bar Kokhba revolt under Hadrian. The reason it's called the Bar Kokhba revolt is there's a man who came up, considered himself to be messianic, at least sufficiently to call himself Bar Kokhba. Do you know what Bar Kokhba means? Son of the Star. It's a messianic title. So he took on a messianic title and claimed that their revolt would do away with the Romans and they could reestablish worship in the temple precincts. Hadrian, through his generals, ultimately put down that revolt in 135, and the result was that the edict went forth from the emperor himself that no Jewish person was to ever step foot in Jerusalem, and as soon as a Jewish person was found in Jerusalem, they were to be immediately put to death. And that is what really ended the hope of the refounding of the Jerusalem temple, because after that, Hadrian built a temple to Zeus on the precincts of the former Jerusalem temple. Okay. So you should know those dates of those other revolts, the one under Trajan and also under Bar Kokhba. All right. And then in circa AD 200, roughly, the Mishnah, which is the first major written codification of rabbinic law, was written. And so you had a transition from the temple worship being the center of Judaism to the synagogue and the rabbis ruling in the synagogues being the main center of Judaism. There was overlap between those two, but that was evidence of that. Okay? All right. Now, I don't know if you can see very well from where you're seated, but you'll notice here's a map of the Mediterranean, Italy, Greece, Asia Minor, Palestine, Mesopotamian area, Egypt, Cyrenaica, which is modern day, we're heading into Libya when we get in this direction. See all the dots up there? All of those dots represent centers of Jewish population in the Herodian period. So when you think Jewish, you typically think Palestine. But you have to realize that in the ancient world, the diaspora had moved the Jewish people, the diaspora, the dispersion, that's what that means, the dispersion had moved Jewish people throughout the whole Roman world. Which is why, if you read through the book of Acts, although Paul calls himself the apostle to the Gentiles, pretty much every time he stops in a new city, where does he go first? The synagogue, if there's a synagogue to be had. And he talks to the Jewish people and to the Gentile proselytes and God-fearers at that place. So that's part of the reality of the nature of Judaism in the ancient world as well. Okay? Some key terms. These are all listed on your thing, but you'll want to take some notes probably at this stage, okay? In terms of Roman social class, today in modern America, we tend to think of social class as an economic reality, okay? What class of person are you? Well, it has to do with how big a car you drive and how big a house you have, right? You know, whether you live in Trump Tower or whether you live in, you know, a hovel someplace in the inner city. That's the kind of distinctions we make in America. There's probably a lot more complexity to American class structure than that, but that's where we typically start. The Roman world was different. There are at least three different kind of identifying marks of class in the Roman world, three different systems, and they overlap and they interplay with one another. And the first was you were either a slave or a freed person or or somebody who's free. Okay? Now, free makes sense. You're not a slave. Slave makes sense. You're a slave, right? By the way, a slave in the ancient world is, we typically want to read 19th century American slavery into passages about slavery in the New Testament. And we have to draw some parallels, but also some distinctions there. Slavery in the ancient world, like slavery in much of history, means that you are possessed by somebody else. You're actually owned by them. So that's a parallel. Slaves in the ancient world could have a very atrocious life, or they could have a very good life, depending on where and in what capacity they were a slave. If you were a slave in the mines, it meant you just had a few years to live. Because if you can imagine the kind of mine accidents that we have nowadays, and all of that, imagine doing that without the contemporary modern technology. So people lasted very few years in the mines, and they were often slaves who worked there. If you were a slave in the fields, in agriculture, it was a hard life, but not an awful life, okay? Depending on who your overseer was and how gently they treated you. Some could treat you very gently. In fact, some of the books about slavery in the ancient world encourage gentle treatment of slaves because they become more productive then, okay? It's an economic decision. It's not the best of motives, but it just is saying that people could be treated somewhat gently. The best place to work if you were a slave usually was in the house. And so you had household slaves. These were considered part of your oikos, which is the Greek word for family. Your family consisted of your husband and wife, children, extended family members, and your slaves. Your slaves are part of your oikos, part of your house, part of your family. And they could receive a variety of treatment there. But especially household slaves could be given very important duties. They might be one of the most educated members of the household, in charge perhaps of educating a child or leading them to their education, being a so-called pedagogue. Or a slave could be an accountant for your business. Or a slave could actually run your business for you. Okay? So slaves could take on some very high and important responsibilities. There were slaves in Caesar's household that were more wealthy than most of the rich people in all of Rome. Okay? Especially when they were ultimately freed. Now, the other class in society were freed persons. Freed slaves, in other words. When you were freed, you were given the responsibility, continued responsibilities to your former slave owner, but they also had responsibilities to you to see your way through society and to establish you in a viable business and to encourage your way through society. Okay? So we'll talk a little bit more about those later. Here's a quote about slaves showing that they can be considered instruments for cultivating the soil alongside oxen and carts. Okay? That level of kind of thing. However, note, overseers should not be allowed to force obedience with whips rather than words if words can achieve the same result. Okay? So there's that. This is some pictures I showed a class yesterday. This is the this is in Ephesus, a library that still stands to this day, Library of Celsus right here. And then this is a very big archway. You can see the people down there as people go into the agora. And the interesting thing about this archway is that it's dedicated to Augustus, the Emperor Augustus, the son of the divine Caesar, son of the divine Julius, who was called high priest and who also possessed the tribune power, etc., and to Livia Caesar Augustus. And then it's also dedicated to Marcus Agrippa. Now, the interesting thing is the people who dedicated it are identified as Mesias and Mithridates to their patron. You can see on this picture here, Mesias was on the previous picture, but here the name Mithridates is specifically mentioned. These appear because of the nature of their name, because they don't have a full identifying name. Usually you would say Mithridates, son of Lucius or something like that. This just says Mithridates. Probably that means he is a former slave. He was a freed person dedicating this arch to his former slaveholders who have now freed him and who are now his patrons. And his patrons, i.e. his former slaveholders, were Marcus Agrippa and also the emperor himself. Now, the kind of money it took to build that arch is phenomenal. And that's the status that a freed person could come to in ancient society. Okay, so, slave, freed person, or free. Another category in ancient Roman thought was, are you a citizen of Rome or not? If you were a citizen of Rome, you had legal privileges and responsibilities that others did not have. So, for instance, if you did a particular heinous crime and you were not a citizen, you would be put to death, usually by a very horrible means, possibly crucifixion. If you were a citizen, it was very unlikely that you would be put to death. If you were, it was probably by the sword, so a quick beheading, very quick, not very painful, as opposed to being stuck on a cross for days until you died. Another example of citizenship is the most likely penalty if you were a Roman citizen and you did something really heinous is you would be sent to exile. Okay? So there was this huge disparity between those who were citizens and those who were not. Citizenship was increasingly being expanded beyond the mere inhabitants of Rome to the inhabitants of Italy and then ultimately to much of the rest of the Roman Empire. And it's in transition in our time period. But there were still people who were citizens, such as Paul, and people who were not. And the distinction was very important in this period. I'm not as worried about this because this doesn't affect the New Testament as much. But basically, these are some of the upper members of society, the patricians and the plebeians. This had to do with your family lineage in Rome itself. And among the patricians, which were the upper classes, there were the senators and the equites. And these basically had to do with how much money your family had. And and such. So that doesn't affect the New Testament so much. Another whole issue in terms of Roman social class was the relationship between patron and client. Okay, a patron was somebody who agreed to oversee the welfare of a group of people who were known as his clients. And this was described as a friendship relationship. This would mean that the patron would give money to the client, that the patron would make sure that they got good deals, that they would help their client get the best spot to open up a shop or something like that. In return, the client would honor the patron by giving them inscriptions, as such as we just saw here, by showing up daily on their doorstep and greeting them, and by helping them run for political office, should they ever choose to run for political office. Okay? So patron-client relationships. And I have here a quote that talks of these patron-client relationships, and I'll read this quote and then we'll stop there because we'll be moving on to another topic in our next time. Men of the lower class have only one way of either earning or repaying favors from our class, and that is by working on our political campaigns and following us around. So you see, one class is patrons, the other class is clients, and you follow them around and you work on their political campaigns. Political campaigns are very different in the ancient world than we typically conceive of them, or at least we like to conceive of them. If I was running for office, I would promise that I would build a building for the city if you elect me. I'll build you guys a new set of stairs to the theater. Those musty old stairs, you know how poorly those are constructed? I'll build you new stairs if you elect me to the position of duovir, to leadership of the city. And if you agree to that, then I'm obligated to do that out of my own money, my own pocket. Okay? And that's how political office was achieved. Honors accrued with it. You also gained power, which could help your own business, because you could throw the contract to rebuilding the stairs to people who work for you, right? That kind of stuff. And so that's why you ran for office. Well, the clients would serve in their political campaigns, etc. This constant attendance, which we have come to expect from men who are honorable and generous, is an appropriate activity for friends, there's our technical word, for friends who are of a lower class, it should say, and who are not as busy, basically. Allow these men who hope to gain everything from us to have something which they can give us in return. As they themselves often say, they cannot plead cases for us, or pledge securities, or invite us to their homes. Well, that implies that that's what the patron does for them. You go to court, I'm your patron, I'll plead your case. And that, therefore, you're more likely to succeed. You want to open a business? I'll put down my money as security that your loan will be paid. You want to show up at somebody's home? I'll invite you to my home if you'll be my client. You know, that's the kind of thing. Right? So that's the nature of patron-client relationships. In other words, if you wanted to advance your course in society, it was best if you came a patron. There are two ways to do that. I could walk up to John and I could say, John, would you be my patron? And he'd say, sure. Or, secondly, I could say, John, I want to be your slave. Because after 7 years of slavery, I become your freed person and you become my patron. So often people sold themselves into slavery as a means of social advancement in the ancient world.